Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Have you been hit by the supply chain breakdown? Our resident logistics expert tells us how we got into this mess.
Surprisingly, people who were now confined at home, they decided they would buy things that they couldn't live without.
And what you can do to help. Plus, the gales of November are coming. Look back on their history with stories from the inland sea.
People in the Twin Ports, I don't think they realize quite enough what treasures that they have for their own heritage.
All that in the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Have you been hit by the supply chain breakdown? Our resident logistics expert tells us how we got into this mess.
Surprisingly, people who were now confined at home, they decided they would buy things that they couldn't live without.
And what you can do to help. Plus, the gales of November are coming. Look back on their history with stories from the inland sea.
People in the Twin Ports, I don't think they realize quite enough what treasures that they have for their own heritage.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Have you been affected by the supply chain issue? Maybe that new car or a used one still hasn't shown up at your local dealer? Or a book you heard is a bestseller is not very good at being bought? Well, it's all part of the latest manifestation of the COVID-19 pandemic that won't seem to go away. But fortunately, we've got someone who knows almost everything about the subject. Richard Stewart is professor of transportation and logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center, and a regular guest on our show as our resident transportation expert. But this time we're talking about that other part of his title, logistics, which I keep accentuating, which is what the supply chain issue is all about. Welcome to Simply Superior, Richard Stewart.
Well, thank you very much, Robin. It's a delight to be on the air with you again.
Normally I ask you, or try to grill you, about what's the latest going on with the can of worms, or trucking around the country, or the region, or even air travel. And we usually don't talk about that other part of your title, logistics. And it sounds like we should have. So tell us what it means and tell us what's going on in the world.
Robin, I always get these small questions from you. let me address just a little historical background. Back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the concept of supply chain hadn't been coined yet. That wasn't until the 1990s. And the logistical concept we had was what we called a push-type system, where we manufactured goods realizing economies of scale by mass production, and we pushed this product out into the marketplace. And if the customer didn't buy it, we would offer coupons and sales, but all too frequently, we ended up with stuff going in the trash. We produced too much and a lot of waste in the system. Interestingly enough, we learned in the 80s from Toyota what we call a lean supply chain system. The whole purpose of it is rather than a push-type system where you're pushing products into the market, you pull the markets based on demand of your customer. And you reduce waste in the logistical stream wherever possible, right down to worker steps. But certainly inventory. You don't carry any more inventory than you need to make the products that are presently demanded and that you forecast demand for. And you provide all the services, production, transportation, everything else based on this lean concept. And this took off really in the late 70s, early 80s, because of very high interest rates. Our younger audience may not realize that back in 79, 80, 81, if you wanted to buy a house, you were paying 12 to 14% interest. Well, this also applied to inventory. So if you were doing mass production and you had lots of parts stored in warehouses, you borrowed money to buy them because you haven't sold the final product. This was an enormous hit to companies. So that's why they adopted lean logistics and embraced it up through the 90s. Supply chain is basically logistics expanded to include finance and some other areas. But we now operate and have since the mid-2000s on a very lean system. It's wonderful for keeping costs down, but for a resilient logistical supply chain, it leaves you little room if you have major disruptions like we've been having.
Mm-hmm. So how real are the disruptions that we've been hearing about? You know, it came on our radar screen a couple of weeks ago when we had Linda Lagarde Grover on, and she was reading her latest book. I happened to get a copy of it, and she told me it was quite rare because the copies that were supposed to show up for a reading of hers actually did arrive just barely in time. But how real is it?
Well, it's very real, and let me give you an idea what caused it to occur. At the same time, we're going with lean logistics systems. We went with global outsourcing. So now we're basing everything on consumer demand, what we forecast we think what the demand will be when we run our production lines. Plus, we're now transporting a lot of this all over the globe. Mm-hmm. So what happened with the pandemic back in March of 20, everybody thought there'd be this enormous downturn in demand. And that was what was forecast by many companies based on the information they had available. Surprisingly, people who were now confined at home began to, with the money they weren't spending at restaurants, coupled with money that came in from the government to support them, they decided they would buy things that they couldn't live without.
You mean we spent our time sitting at home ordering stuff?
Well, yes. Strange as this may sound, that's what occurred. I was one of them, and I'm certain many other listeners were too.
Did you buy anything good?
Well, the cumulative effect was that when the forecasts were done for the coming months by all these production and transportation companies that operate these global supply chains, they said, boy, we're going to expect not to have much demand until this pandemic is gone. And that may take months, maybe even a year or two. So they cut way back on inventory, way back on production capacity, and were caught flat-footed when come April, May, actual sales were much higher than forecast.
April and May of 2020 or 2021?
2020.
Or both? Okay.
The ships were laid up, truck drivers were laid off. All kinds of things were done based on forecasted demand. Remember, we now operate very lean systems. So we have very little room for recovery assets to apply and bring this back up to operation again. Plus, the pandemic didn't go away. So that, coupled with a labor shortage in many key industries, when you reduce the number of longshoremen into a port to the bare minimum for a lean supply chain, and then a large percentage of them either come down with COVID or get quarantined and can't work, that further disrupts it. The same way with ships, the same way with production facilities. So these have all compounded to create what we call the bullwhip effect in the supply chain, if you think of how a bullwhip goes through a series of sine curves, and this ripples through the whole supply chain. Mm-hmm. And it takes considerable time to correct this. And keep in mind, we're one nation ordering.
Everybody else is too, right?
Well, actually, no.
Oh.
It was very interesting. I took a group of students to the Intermodal Association of North America conference in Long Beach, where the students got to see 60, 70 ships at anchor out in the harbor. But part of the conference was they had industry experts talking about stuff, and they had a individual representing the steamship companies from Denmark on. Mm-hmm. And the individual made a point of saying, what you're doing in America, ordering all this stuff online and going on a buying spree, if you will, is not occurring in Europe. We don't have that flush cash and the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you're a production facility in China, you've got two different demand forecasts coming at you, one from Europe's markets and the other from the U.S. market. And he pointed out that the supply chain disruptions that we're seeing are much greater in the United States than they are in others because of the distorted demand. So doesn't mean it's bad. I don't mean that negative. It's just much different than what you're seeing in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the lean concept, you're speaking of not keeping as much inventory in stores. And I can think of any number of times that I've gone to a particular store looking for something and they say, no, we don't have it right here, but we can order it.
Yeah, well, it's not only inventory, but it is also all the elements of the supply chain, the warehousing, the ports, the ships. You have just enough to make the system run and a little bit extra to handle buffer stock. Mm-hmm. But you don't carry a large reserve to deal with significant disruptions.
Which is what we had.
Which is what we've had, further compounded by a pandemic that doesn't seem to want to go away. And so just when you think you have your system up and operating, and you're moving the cargo out of the ports, you find out that you're short tens of thousands of truck drivers who were laid off and found a different profession.
We are speaking with Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. And today we are focusing on logistics, which includes the whole supply chain issues that many of us are beginning to feel if we haven't already. So how does this play out locally?
Well, let's talk about one up here in the North Country. Some of the people who were sitting at home in 2020 with little to do decided they'd rebuild decks, garages, whatever they thought they were capable of, and had a significant run on Menards, Home Depot, all these places that handle wood, driving up the price of wood products. They, like all other industries, were caught flat-footed in terms of a demand they didn't expect. So they didn't have the supplies. The price went up. Now we see that price reversing itself and going down. But people who harvest wood, process wood, they're trying to keep up with this seesaw of demand. And that's coupled with the fact that this is an industry where during the spring, when the thaws are there, you can't pull wood out of the woods. Your trucks can't get through with it. And they're having to grapple with that seasonality issue in the supply and demand, as well as the distortion of the market. And so you're starting to see some of the wood products companies around here trying to find drivers, trying to meet that demand. So that's a local example of this disruption caused. Another local example, which is tied to the global, you go and try and buy new cars, and it's difficult. Not because they don't make cars, but the market for the computer chips was distorted because people actually bought lots of the chips for electronic devices to use at home, and they took it away from the automobiles to sell to that immediate market because they thought the demand for automobiles would go down. And once again, caught short-footed.
You know what? I think you just clarified Linda Lagarde Grover's example, because I think she was saying it wasn't just whatever the shipping issues were, but I believe that they weren't printed. And they may not have been printed, because what do you print books on? Paper, and paper comes from wood, and you just told us about wood issues.
Yes. Not all wood can be used for paper, different wood products and everything else. But, you know, if you remember in 2020... in this area of our country, we had Verso shut down here in northern Wisconsin and other paper companies. And that sends a ripple through the whole supply chain. resulting in not enough paper to print books?
Resulting in me getting a coveted copy of Linda LaGuard Grover's book. We are speaking with Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center, and we are very much focusing on logistics today.
One of the interesting side effects of this is that we are an area that produces a lot of iron ore that goes for steel production. We have historically competed in the past half century with foreign steel production, either from Russia or from China, from foreign countries. These foreign countries have been impacted by both the pandemic, but their own shortages. Right now, China is facing a tremendous shortage in energy, and the price of their steel has gone up, making our homemade steel more competitive. Plus, you have shipping delays. It's not just containers, consumer goods, but these ports are jam-packed with other ships trying to get in. So getting the steel when you're bringing it in from foreign markets is more difficult. Accessing that steel domestically is to a degree easier. So we've seen some pickup in the movement of iron ore on the Great Lakes by the ships, because demand for that product in the steel mills in the U.S. has grown.
That sounds like good news for us, but it doesn't sound sustainable either. Things will change, right?
Well, markets always change. If we went back 40 years, we wouldn't be talking about importing massive amounts of goods from China.
Mm-hmm.
So markets will change. Africa may be our next China 50 years from now. A lot's going to be impacted by what happens with climate change.
And I shouldn't say that it isn't necessarily sustainable. I should say just don't get too comfortable.
Well, in business, you always have to keep track of your competitors and make certain that you can produce and deliver better than your competitor.
What can we as consumers do other than maybe not order so much from Amazon?
Well, of course, on a personal budget perspective, it's always best to order what you really need. I'm talking about excess inventory in manufacturing and other areas. You could have excess inventory in your closet with garments you bought that you wore once and they've been sitting there for a number of years. So getting rid of excess inventory within your own household and not acquiring excess inventory gives you a leaner, more efficient, and less costly lifestyle. You will need to order what you need to have a quality lifestyle, and that will vary from individual to individual.
You remind me of something that I inadvertently, but because of supply chain issues, did to become more efficient or... I have a bicycle that the crank was making a particular noise and kind of annoying me, and I took it in and thought I had it repaired, but was still making the noise. So I decided that, well, I need a new bike, but I found out this was exactly as you said, in the middle of what we thought was the middle of the pandemic, if it ever ends. The bike shops all said, there are no bikes, you can't get a bike. So that got me to say, I'll use it anyway and see how far it gets. And after three rides, the noise disappeared. Apparently, it needed to be pedaled a bit. And so I did exactly what you said, eliminating my own waste. I didn't throw that bike away or let it sit around here and buy a new one.
Well, you asked, what can consumers do? One of the aspects that disrupts supply chains is what we call reverse logistics. And that is when you buy goods online or you buy goods in stores, though it's less common when you physically buy the goods. But when you buy online, there's a certain degree of impulse buying. There's also a certain degree of customer error. You thought you were a different size than you ordered, however you want to put that diplomatically. And the end result is you get a garment or you get some object that, when it does arrive and you look at it, you go, oh, it's not what I need, not what I have in mind, whatever the reason, and you send it back. Well, now the supply chain has to deal with a product moving back through the transportation systems, back into warehouses. The companies have to decide, Can it be resold? Does it need to be recycled? Does it have to be thrown away? Some studies have indicated as much as 30% of what's ordered online is returned. So that has a significant negative impact on the operation of a supply chain. It also has to add the cost of the initial purchase, because now we're having to spend money as a business to deal with these unwanted goods. And we have to recover that loss by increasing the prices on the goods we sell. So buying what you need in the right quantity and being reflective on that before you make the purchase, despite all the marketing that comes out at you, and it's tremendous, is helpful in reducing that bullwhip effect of the supply chain.
You're always telling me when I ask you for predictions about the transportation situation, what's going on in airlines or the roads or whatever, that you don't really have a crystal ball. But if you did, what would be your prediction about the ultimate, you know, resolution of the supply chain problem? And I know there's a big asterisk on that, because it's the same issue we've been talking about, is when and if this pandemic will ever end, right?
Well, yes. Most predictions are based on historical data. The pandemic last occurred 100 years ago, and we very rarely look that far back to do trends for the next year. So I'm going to tell you again, my crystal ball is very cloudy because I'm not quite sure when this pandemic will end, when people will get their vaccinations and we'll be able to move ahead without that sort of Damocles hanging over our heads. So assuming that it tapers off within the next year in terms of restrictions for travel, for workers and what they have to wear at work, masks, vaccinated, things like this, all these requirements which change your ability to keep the workplace flowing smoothly. I'm always impressed by how much we've done in spite of having to take lots of precautions, in spite of the unfortunate illnesses and even deaths that have occurred in the hundreds of thousands. We still managed to keep most of our supply chains operating and our logistics systems flowing fairly well. So that tells me we have talented people and systems that will rise up as soon as they can to operate at maximum efficiency. But what we need to keep in mind is this is a global pandemic. This is not a U.S. pandemic. And so we deal with a global economy. The clothes we wear, the food we get, everything else comes from all over the world. And we may be able to tackle this problem in the U.S., get people vaccinated, get things under control. But other countries whom we rely on, either for finished goods or raw materials, if they're not successfully dealing with keeping the pandemic in control, they will continue to disrupt the supply chain that we rely on.
I'm looking for some optimism in there, but I guess more than anything else, you're giving us realism.
Well, I'm also very optimistic as that we have talented, very capable people out there to run these systems, mm-hmm. who will, as I said, step forward every chance they get to improve and remove the obstacles. But it's not a national issue. It's a global issue. It's like climate change. If we're not working globally to address it all together, we're working at cross purposes.
Well, on that sobering note, we've been speaking with Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and I look forward to talking with you and speaking with your audiences in the future. Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, the Gales of November and their legacy. And if you know-
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. My weather app has shown a pretty mild forecast for most of this week, but don't count on it staying that way for long, especially on Lake Superior. We're officially more than halfway through autumn, and the gales of November will surely come slashing, to quote Gordon Lightfoot. Marking the season is the Lake Superior Marine Museum with this Gales of November program next week, November 11th through 13th. And here to tell us about those activities is Connie LeMay, the museum's board president and also the editor of Lake Superior magazine. Welcome to Simply Superior, Connie.
Hey, thanks, Robin. Nice to hear from you.
And also with us to tell Connie more than she ever knew about the Big Lake and the vessels that plowed it, or tried to, is Laura Jacobs, the archivist of the Maritime Collection at the University of Wisconsin-Superior's Jim Danhill Library. Welcome to Simply Superior, Laura.
Thank you, Robin.
So, Connie, we will start with you. And what's the most bet-you-never-knew activity on the agenda for this year's event? So you got to tell us something we haven't done before.
on the Gales of November program?
Yep, we know the Gales of November will be here.
That's right. I do have to tell you, many years in a row when we've had events, the doors have been blown open by the gales during the event. So that works out just perfectly fine. This year, we're not going to have that problem because we are doing a virtual event rather than the in-person Gales of November. The good news is instead of 2 days, though, we'll stretch it across 3 days. So usually it's a full day of activity on Saturday, a half day on Friday. And this year we're going to just have one speaker Thursday, one speaker Friday, and two speakers on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. And is there something you haven't done before?
Well, one of the topics this year, one of the things that I'm particularly tickled to be able to have as one of our speakers and events is the Lake Superior Marine Museum Association has started a project, an oral history project. We'll be doing maritime heritage in general, but the first area that we're concentrating on is the heritage and history of commercial fishing. And so one of our programs will be introducing some of the spectacular video work that our two main board members who are working on that project have been involved with in the past year, trying to capture some of the, especially some of the older people connected to commercial fishing who we want to make sure their voices are heard.
Well, you were gracious enough to share with me a clip from a film about part of those histories called Lost But Not Forgotten. Let's take a listen.
So after weathering a huge storm on McCormick's and doing all of that, they lost most of their nets, are on the bottom of the lake around here now.
They were down on the south side, down around McCormick's Reef, and they got into some terrible weather. And they split the planking away from the keel, and they had to run in to Long Point Beach.
And that was a clip from the film Lost But Not Forgotten about the fishing heritage on Lake Superior.
Yes. And ultimately, what we'll have, besides this wonderful video archive of people talking about their history with the commercial fishing, we hope will also be a look at what's happening now and into the future on Lake Superior.
Laura, tell us about the collection. You quote Captain Richard Stewart, as you call him, and we call him Dr. Stewart, and he's our other segment today, talking about logistics, that supply chain problem. But you quote him as insisting the collection is more than just shipwrecks.
More than just shipwrecks, and he prefers to think about ships above the water. Thank you very much.
Right. We say that with all respect.
Oh, absolutely. Well, because Connie mentioned the information about the commercial fishermen, one of the hidden pieces of the collections is actually fishing statistics from all of the small boats in this end of Lake Superior, from Cornucopia down and around, and including Isle Royale, as those different catches were recorded up through the early 1960s, I believe. The original survey of the harbor from 1861, which is a lovely drawing by the Corps of Engineers of all of the harbor depths and the consistency of the bottom and so on in the harbor prior to the development of the ports, which is very, very cool.
How accurate was that, by the way?
Oh, extremely accurate. They still go back to the 1861 chart all the time.
Wow.
One of the things I love about the archives is the glass-plated negatives that they have. Are they negatives or positives, Laura? Within the collection, some really fascinating images from back in the day.
Among the glass plate negatives were a series of photographs taken by the photographer Hugh McKenzie of Superior, who just coincidentally happened to be in what is now Canal Park, taking pictures of weather. So he happened to be in Canal Park in November of 1905 with an entire box full of unexposed glass plate negatives, and he caught the entire wreck of the Matafa as it occurred. And what's interesting, it became known as the Matafa storm. It's one of the most severe storms of November on Lake Superior. And the Matafa was merely the most spectacular of the wrecks because it happened to occur in full view of the entire city of Duluth. But it was, 12th maybe shipwreck of the storm. It also included the Crescent City, the Lafayette in Manila, the Edinbourne and the Madeira, the England, the Elwood, the Spencer and Amboy, the Corrie, as well as the Matafa and the Crescent City. They all occurred on November 28th of 1905.
All right. Well, then we should take the gales of November quite seriously.
Indeed.
We're speaking with Laura Jacobs, the archivist of the Maritime Collection at the University of Wisconsin-Superior's Jim Danhill Library, and Connie LeMay, the Lake Superior Marine Museum's board president, and also the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. We're talking about activities for the Gales of November program happening next week, November 11th through 13th. That's Thursday through Saturday. So one of the other virtual programs that you have going on is the View from Split Rock. So what's the view, and who's viewing it and telling us about it?
Well, Lee Ransack for almost 40 years was what we would call the keeper of Split Rock Lighthouse. He was the site manager of the historic site that is operated by the Minnesota Historical Society. And he retired a couple of years, about a year and a half back. And meanwhile, he also has written a memoir of his time at the lighthouse. The interesting thing about Lee's experiences at the lighthouse is that he didn't simply come and go to his job. He and his family, his wife and two children, lived at Split Rock, just as the new lightkeeper, Hayes Scriven, does with his family. And so it's a kind of an interesting perspective on a job. It's not just coming and going, but actually being out in a relatively remote site over the course of several decades.
Mm-hmm. Laura, do you have any lighthouse materials in your collection?
We do have some lighthouse materials, not only of Split Rock, but those on Isle Royale, as well as, of course, all of our local lights, including the technical drawings, the blueprints of both the Duluth and Superior entry lights.
So if I want to, I can build my own, yes?
Best of luck with that.
Although, you know, Robin, that both the South Pier and North Pier lighthouses at the end of the piers in Duluth, the federal government is trying to find different people to take over those lighthouses. So you could just have a lighthouse.
Right. And with the plans for the light, just in case, right?
That's right.
Is the collection all paper, or as you mentioned, glass plate materials, or do you have audio or visual?
Well, the maritime collection began with the Lake Superior Marine Museum's original archives material, which was itself very substantial. I have lots and lots of photographs, many photographs. There are some other media, but I have not had much opportunity to, because they tend to be in old formats, to convert them so that people can actually access them. One thing that came in within the last year and a half that is not yet accessible is film footage, motion picture type film from the shipyards during World War II, taken by Harold Andreessen, and was featured in a film made by the Superior Public Library called Remembering the Globe, which was one of the many shipyards in the area at that time.
And with the magic of the internet, I see that it's online on YouTube, and let's take a listen to part of it.
As the wedges went in the ship, the keel blocks were knocked out, and the launch crew ran from beneath the vessel. The launch master, frequently Bob Fraser, signaled the sponsor that she could break the traditional bottle of champagne on the vessel's bow. We were a little different at the Globe, using our own northern beer as a substitute. It was made here in Superior. Then the launch master would push a button that dropped the guillotines on the hawsers or slings. With the slings cut, the ship would move slowly on the waves and slide into the water, pitching up a huge wave.
And that was fortuitously part of a film, Remembering the Globe, part two, it says, a documentary about shipbuilding in Superior, for which some of the footage is in some condition at the Maritime Collection of the Jim Danhill Library at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. We are speaking with Laura Jacobs, the archivist of the collection, and Connie LeMay, the Lake Superior Marine Museum's board president and the editor of Lake Superior Magazine. So, Connie, rather than just go to the library and the special collection, we could go to the museum, right? That's why you're a museum. So what do we see there every day of the year without even the events going on?
That's right. Well, the association that I'm with is kind of an interesting hybrid sort of a thing, you might say, because we are the nonprofit partner with the Lake Superior Maritime Visitors Center, which is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer-run visitor center at the bottom of the aerial lift bridge, fondly known as the Marine Museum. And so while the Corps operates that center, the artifacts and such within it are gathered by and under the auspices of the association. And so we have some really spectacular new displays and stuff at the Visitor Center that the association has been able to help fund and raise. And I would just really encourage people in the Twin Ports. I don't think they realize quite enough what treasures that they have for their own heritage. So because in part of COVID that we had a couple of cool, nifty new things brought into the visitor center that probably not a lot of people have gotten a chance to take a look at. One is a hoot of a display that's interactive, where you are the one helping to raise and lower a boat in the Sioux Locks. So between a video and a panel actually from the Sioux Locks, you can mess around with helping to take a boat through the lock system. And then there's a number of other new things. One of the displays that touches me is the reworking of the display for the acknowledging the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald that emphasizes the crew members, the names of the crew members and the people who were lost, many of whom still have relatives, living relatives within the Twin Ports area. And so I like that new focus of that exhibit that talks not just about the well-known ship, but about the people who moved that ship and were lost because of that wreck.
Right. And I can't stress enough what you just said about the, as Gordon Lightfoot put it, faces and names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. You know, one thing you mentioned about local people not necessarily realizing what's at the museum or the visitor center probably is the word visitor, right? Because this is the heart of Canal Park, and that's where all the visitors are, and locals should know that that applies to them too. And I was going to ask you for an address, but you gave it, the foot of the lift bridge. If you can't find that, then you're in trouble.
That's right. There's a tugboat on the ground outside of it. You can't miss it. And then, of course, the other thing is all of the maritime heritage places within Superior as well. So I'd be remiss if I didn't remind people about the Meteor and its history. It turned 125 this year, as well as the Edna G. tugboat up in Two Harbors.
Take us back to the program. Where can we find out more information about it? Again, the dates and...
Well, the best thing to do is keep an eye out for lsmma.com. So Lake Superior Marine Museum Association, lsmma.com. We're doing the links for the Zoom talks, all of which are free. We encourage donations if you can do it, but the talks are free, so definitely do those. Besides Lee, who we mentioned, there's also Dan Rao. He's the one doing the commercial fishing. He also used to be captain of the L.L. Smith over there at the UWS. And then we also have Bruce Lynn, head of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point on the eastern end of Lake Superior, and Roger Lelève, who everyone who is a boat nerd knows of the annual guide Know Your Ships. And Roger is the publisher now of that annual publication, and his talk, I think, is appropriately called How I Became the Luckiest Boat Nerd in the World. I also want to mention, though, that in addition to the talks this year, we're going to be having a silent auction online, and that includes some historic pieces off of boats. And then we have...
So you're saying that I could buy a lighthouse light?
Not a lighthouse light. No, those things are rare.
As opposed to
Robin,
building one myself from Laura's plans?
that we'd fight you for, actually. But yeah, no, those things are rare. But to see everything that's happening around the Gales of November program, including the speakers and the online auction, and also a great package connected to donating to the association.
All right. And lastly, Laura, we're going to give you the last words. What's your favorite item in your collection?
Oh, gosh, that's really tough.
Or what's the most popular item? Is there one thing that people come in and before they even open their mouths, you know exactly what they're asking for?
Blueprints. Blueprints of ships. Just before this, I was talking to someone who was inquiring for blueprints. Lots of model builders out there, a lot of underwater archaeologists.
All right. Well, I wouldn't have guessed that. So the blueprint that I was already going to ask to borrow for my lighthouse, apparently somebody else has dibs on it. Well, they don't get to keep it either. We've been speaking with Connie LeMay, the Lake Superior Marine Museum's board president and the editor of Lake Superior Magazine, and Laura Jacobs, the archivist for the Maritime Collection at the University of Wisconsin-Superior's Jim Dan Hill Library. We've been talking about the activities for the Gales of November program that is happening next week, Thursday through Saturday, November 11th through 13th. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for helping get the word out, Robin.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Hello, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, earlier in the show, Professor Stewart, and he says, by the way, you don't have to call him Professor or Captain Stewart, just Richard will do. He told us how the supply chain issue, which is a worldwide problem with local implications, was related to climate change. And there's a major climate change conference going on right now that also has local implications.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, heat has been rising on world leaders to tackle climate change, and they've been meeting this week in the United Kingdom for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. And that summit aims to speed up efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions worldwide, which Wisconsin climate activists and northern Wisconsin residents say is sorely needed. You know, more than 40 countries during this week have pledged to end the use of coal before 2050, but the U.S. isn't signing on to those plans just yet, despite President Joe Biden's goal to get away from coal in the power sector by 2035. And these leaders are working to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius as set out under the Paris Agreement. But a UN panel has warned that temperatures are likely to cross that level of warming in the next decade. And as the climate warms, you know, scientists say that that will bring more frequent intense storms like the ones that we've seen in northern Wisconsin in 2012 and 2016 and 2018. And Bill Bussey with the Shawamigan chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby notes that those storms have caused tens of millions of dollars in damage to public infrastructure throughout the region. And so Wisconsin researchers also say that, you know, these kinds of very extreme storms, like the ones in 2012, 2016, and 2018, they're becoming disproportionately more common as temperatures rise. And so that could, you know, have big implications for what the region might be dealing with if we don't see some action to, you know, limit temperatures from rising and seeing the worst effects of climate change.
Well, all that sounds like some pretty serious warning signs. And we've got some signs of change, or change signs perhaps, sending some positive messages on our local roads.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation unveiled the first dual language sign in Bayfield County this week in partnership with the Red Cliff Tribe. The agency is working with Wisconsin tribes to update their signage on state highways so that they can display the English and native words for tribes' names. And the sign near Red Cliff now displays Red Cliff and the tribal name, the Miskwabikang, including the tribe seal and population. And I apologize if I, you know, didn't do very well on the pronunciation, but Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson said they're excited about the dual language signs. You know, it signifies a sense of place for Red Cliff and other tribes. And Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Christopher Boyd said that they're honored to be the first tribe to do this and show visitors that they're entering the boundaries of the reservation with the tribal name. And if you're wondering, Ga Miskwabikang means the place where there is Red Rock Cliff. So I think anybody that's been to Red Cliff will understand why that is.
Cool. And I'm glad you put the translation in there, because now when I see that sign, I know what I'm looking at. One more footnote to our Gales of November conversation. A new ore boat has been launched for the Great Lakes.
Yeah, the first U.S.-flagged Great Lakes freighter to be built on the lakes in almost 40 years went into the water for the first time last week at Fincantieri Bay Shipbuilding in Sturgeon Bay. And the Mark W. Barker will become the newest addition to Interlake Steamship Company's fleet. The launching is, you know, a maritime tradition where it marks the first time a boat is transferred from the land into the water, and it's meant to bless the new vessel and its crew. And the ship isn't ready just yet to head out on the lakes, though. Some work will continue on the interior and mechanical and engineering systems, but it's expected ready in the spring.
All right. That's definitely a good sign for our future. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on all the local, regional, and statewide news between our shows and at any time at WPR.org/news. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we leave you with what else? Gordon Lightfoot's immortal classic, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Stay safe, everyone.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down, of the big lake they call Gitche Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?